Here I am. My guest is Professor Michio Kaku, and his book is Physics of the Impossible, rocketing to number 12 on the bestseller list. Not there yet, but he's received information that that's where it's going next. I had heard 18, but headed for 12, so this is going to be a big one for the professor, and so it should be. Actually, the impossibilities are classed by the professor. Class 1 impossibilities, Class 2, and Class 3 impossibilities. And I have a specific question about Class 3, but first the environment coming up next. Well, all right. Professor, gosh, so many of these things like teleportation is certainly a prime example, and many of these other impossibilities that look as though they might be on the horizon would solve so many of our problems. For example, what's going on in the world right now? We already know the ice at the North Pole seems to be melting away quite rapidly. Now we're hearing that large chunks of the Antarctic are beginning to fall away. Now, that's those are the ice cubes that are outside the glass being chunked in. So that seems pretty serious to me. Are these things that are coming going to come, in your opinion, quickly enough?
Well, I think every climatologist has been shocked at the rate at which the atmosphere has been changing. Yes. If you go back to the literature 10 years, there were dire predictions made 10 years ago. And if you go back to them from today's perspective, you realize that they were all off. They were much too conservative.
That's right.
10 years ago, nobody predicted that we would have a potential loss of the entire North Polar region by mid-century. And yet that seems to be coming. It's a foregone conclusion now among many climatologists, a foregone conclusion that we have already passed the point of no return concerning the North Polar ice sheet. And future maps of the world, pictures of the Earth from outer space, will no longer show the North Polar region. It'll just be clear ice for most of the year.
Serious as that may be, once the ice down south begins to melt, we've got a real problem, because that ice, of course, is all on land, or that is to say above water level, and will add to the ocean level. So when you begin to hear about big chunks breaking off down there, it's time to worry.
That's right. And already there are projections as to how many dikes we're going to have to put around Manhattan, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Boston. There are maps on the internet showing what Boston will look like by mid-century, and most of it is going to look underwater, just like it was in the pre-revolutionary days.
Yes.
And Wall Street will be pretty much underwater. And many of the familiar landmarks, especially in Florida, are going to be underwater.
Yes. And so again, the question is, with all these wonderful things on the horizon, mm-hmm. they look awfully far out there when you look at the pace of deteriorating climate.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think every climatologist underestimated the rapidity with which the seasons are changing, rapidity with which the polar regions are changing, the recession of glaciers is changing, the migration of insects is changing, certain areas becoming more desert, and extreme mm-hmm. swings of the weather. Who would have thought that 10 years ago? All the predictions 10 years ago were much, much too conservative, as we now know.
So I ought not press you on this, but, you know, these changes, it just doesn't seem like they're going to come fast enough.
Fast enough for what?
For us. For us. In other words, as quickly as the climate is changing, mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about mid-century mm-hmm. Being in serious trouble, mm-hmm. and you're talking about teleportation, perhaps at a usable level a few hundred years away.
Oh, I see. Whether or not these technologies can save us
from
the worst effects of our own follies.
Yes.
That remains to be seen. I tend to think that a solar hydrogen economy is about 10, 15 years away. The cost of oil keeps rising. The cost of solar hydrogen keeps dropping. And within 10 to 15 years, the two curves are going to cross. And when the two curves cross, that's when we start to make the transition to a solar hydrogen economy.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, maybe fusion on a 30-year time scale, maybe fusion power. The French are putting all their eggs in the fusion basket. They're building the world's most advanced fusion reactor, the ITER, in southern France. And all the industrialized nations are chipping in money, betting that in the far future, now mid-century, perhaps fusion could kick in. My worry is that fusion may kick in too late. And by that point, we'll pass many points of no return.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be beyond our capabilities to stop the melting of the North Polar region, the breakup of the South Pole, rising sea levels, growing dust bowls, migration of insects, changing of the seasons. It may not be fast enough.
I note that you class your impossibilities as 1, 2, and 3. And I remember that you had a type 1 planet, a type 2 planet, a type 3, well, not planets, but
civilizations.
Civilizations, yes. Three types of civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
Is it kind of like that?
Sort of. Class 1 impossibilities are impossibilities that will be possible within 10 years to 50 to 100 years. And most of what you see in science fiction, like telepathy and artificial intelligence and invisibility, most of that are class 1 impossibilities. Class 2 impossibilities may take centuries to millennia, and that includes time travel. We think that it's an engineering problem, a huge engineering problem, but one that can be surmounted by an advanced civilization. Time travel, we think, is for maybe a type 2 or type 3 civilization.
No, you just run through it. In other words, tough, tougher, and toughest.
And toughest, right.
Right, okay. A class 1 would include force fields, invisibility, phasers and Death Stars, teleportation, telepathy, psychokinesis, robots, extraterrestrials and UFOs, starships, antimatter, and anti-universes. Now, we'll touch on some more of those. But way off in class 3 impossibilities, I see you have listed precognition.
And perpetual motion machines.
Mm-hmm. But why precognition?
Well, we have two great theories of physics that we see no deviation from. We have, on one hand, the quantum theory of the atom, which gives us electronics, laser beams, the internet, iPods. Then we have Einstein's theory of black holes and the Big Bang. These are the two great theories. Now, if those two great theories were shown to be wrong or to have loopholes, then perhaps we're going to have to revise our understanding of what I call class 3 impossibilities. But class 3 impossibilities violate relativity and violate the quantum theory, like perpetual motion machines and precognition. Now, time travel is of a different category. We think a time machine may be possible, and we can still preserve causality, cause and effect, so that you cannot go backwards in time and your teenage mother falls in love with you and spurns your father. So how could you be born if your teenage mother fell in love with you? We think we can answer these things by having the river of time fork into two rivers, in which case you've met a teenage girl who looks like your mother, acts like your mother, is genetically identical to your teenage mother, but is somebody else's teenage mother, because you've entered a new timeline. The river of time has forked into two rivers. So we think the causality law, the cause and effect, will still be maintained even if we have time travel.
If that occurs, does the rest of the universe change at that same instant?
That's right. Another universe would then open up at that point, and the river of time would fork into two rivers.
Okay.
And a time traveler has simply gone from one time stream to another time stream. So if you monkey with the past, you're monkeying with somebody else's past, not your own. So you cannot kill your parents before you're born. If you do kill your parents before you're born, you kill somebody else's parents who look like your parents when they were young, but they are not your parents. Your parents gave birth to you. So in that sense, even with a time machine, you do not have precognition.
Well, if all of this may one day be possible, then it must be going on now, which means we must be experiencing these splits now.
That's right. If you take this seriously, this is called the many worlds theory.
Or it's never going to happen.
Well, the many worlds theory is gaining in acceptance among physicists. I have friends, several friends of mine are Nobel laureates, and they all believe now in the many worlds theory, in which case Elvis Presley could be alive in another parallel universe. We physicists take this seriously. In fact, we even say that, that in these other universes, you would have a counterpart, that Elvis Presley could still be alive. You could have a brother or sister that does not exist in this universe, or maybe in the other universes you don't exist because your parents had a miscarriage. These are all possibilities that send the mind spinning, but yeah, we physicists take these seriously.
I'm just wondering why precognition falls into a class 3 impossibility.
Yeah, not that it is totally impossible. Class 3 impossibilities simply violate the two great theories. Now, the two great theories don't talk to each other. They're incomplete. That's where string theory comes in, which is what I do for a living. That's my day job, working in string theory.
Yes.
String theory, in fact, I'm the founder of string field theory, which is one of the main branches of string theory. The string theory now allows you to unify these two great theories, but even within string theory, we don't see any violation of causality. So that's why I'm saying that precognition may be possible, but not within the framework of known physics.
Okay.
Or for that matter, perpetual motion machines. For example,
well, I believe that you and I have spoken of this before, but precognition is the one thing in this whole list that I actually have experienced myself, truly, one adult to another, no lie, no exaggeration, I experienced it. Do you recall my speaking of
no.
this?
No, could you refresh my memory?
Sure. I lived long ago in Santa Barbara, California. I lived in a little, what were called garden apartments, and I worked for a radio station in Santa Barbara. And I came home from work one day, as I would do every day. I would come home from work, sit down, and watch the evening news. Now, I had no choice but to park my car sort of directly in front of the sliding glass doors to the apartment, so I could look right out the door and I could see my car. Okay. So I come home, park the car, go inside, turn on the TV, watch the news. I begin to have wave after wave after wave. That's the only way I can describe it. It was so strong that it felt like ocean waves crashing over my brain saying, your car is going to be hit. Your car is going to be hit. It was ridiculous. I felt it was ridiculous. So I got up, went across the room, opened the curtains, looked out at my car. It was fine. I said a four-letter word. Went over and sat back down and watched the news. The moment I sat down, the moment it came crashing back, someone's going to hit your car, someone's going to hit your car.
Right.
So I said another four-letter word, got up, disturbed the newscast, which I wanted to see, went over, opened the curtains, looked out, the car was fine. But wait, here's a guy on the sidewalk walking down, and I watched him. I think it might have been during a commercial break. I watched him walk down the sidewalk, get into the car in front of mine, start the engine, put it in reverse, and crash into my car. yeah, no joke, no lie, no exaggeration. It freaked me out so badly, I sunk to my knees, but revived myself quickly enough to yell at him, hey, I saw that. Okay, okay, I'm stopping. You know, it was no big deal, a bent fender and so forth, but nothing awful. But I tell you, Professor, I swear to you, what I just said is exactly true.
Wow, that's really spooky, huh?
Spooky. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as if I saw something that was going to occur a year from now. But there was no mistaking what it was.
Right.
It just washed over me in wave after wave. Now, it's never happened since. It never happened before. But my God, it was strong. Now, what was that?
Wow, I guess after experiencing something like that, you become a real true believer. I mean, firsthand experience, right?
I don't know what you believe in. You believe you have to start asking questions, yes.
Yeah, well, it really does kind of shake you up, you know, when you confront it firsthand, you know, close encounters of the third kind.
Well, right? Okay, so in the world of physics, what could account for that?
Well, there is something in the theory of light called advanced solutions. This was an embarrassment for 100 years. But these solutions communicate with the future. We all know that when you send light across a room, light progresses in a normal way. Light does not go into the future. But if you look at what are called Maxwell's equations, they have retarded solutions, which we see all around us, which travel the speed of light. But then we also have advanced solutions that allow you to communicate with the future. So in principle, you could have a telephone conversation between the future and the past, and somebody could give you all the stock quotations of the future. Now, this was an embarrassment for 100 years. Maxwell's equations are the foundation of modern society, radio, television, antennas. If you're an engineer or physicist, you have to memorize Maxwell's equations, or you cannot get your advanced degree. It's as simple as that. But Maxwell's equations have these advanced solutions. So for a while, some people thought that maybe it is possible to have a telephone conversation with the future or the past using these solutions.
But all of these things are light or sublight, right? So,
well, Richard Feynman, Nobel laureate, finally found the solution in 1949, for which he won the Nobel Prize in 1965. And it shocked the world of physics when he found the solution. And the solution is antimatter. It turns out that when ordinary matter goes backwards in time, we call it antimatter. So antimatter is ordinary matter going backwards in time. Now, you may say to yourself, well, that's bizarre. But hey, yes, that won the Nobel Prize in physics and has been verified by every experiment since then. That is the secret of antimatter. People wonder, how come nature created antimatter? It's just this extraneous double of ordinary matter. And the reason is it takes advantage of precisely these advanced solutions. So Richard Feynman showed that it is possible in some sense that matter can go backwards in time. Then you could, you know, set up these bizarre telephone conversations. But because it is just antimatter, and we play with antimatter, causality is restored, because even though it's matter going backwards in time, from our perspective, we go forwards in time, cause and effect are still established. So what Richard Feynman did was he plugged the loophole, this loophole of being able to see the future, which was an embarrassment ever since 1860 when Maxwell first wrote down his equations. So it explained the mystery of antimatter and the mystery of whether or not you could have a telephone conversation with the future. But, well, I guess when you experience it firsthand, though, it really shakes you up, right?
Well, it sure does. As I said, so badly it put me on my knees for a moment. But now, dispassionately looking back at it, I don't doubt it for a second. It really happened. I just wonder, was my car sending me a message?
Well, let me tell you a little teeny bit of precognition. When I wrote the book, I had to address, you know, movies like Star Wars, where they have Death Stars, and Death Stars can blow up entire planets. And people laugh at that. They said that George Lucas went overboard with the Death Star. You can't blow up a planet. Actually, you can blow up a planet. And I even mentioned in the book that a dying star, an unstable star, could go supernova, shoot radiation through the North Pole and the South Pole, and like a gun barrel, fry Alderaan or fly the Earth. Well, it's almost like precognition. Just a few weeks ago, it's already buzzing on the internet. Scientists are tracking WR104. It is an unstable star, just like I predicted in my book, and it is pointed at us.
WR104?
Yeah, go to Google and just type in WR104, and you have all these websites from astronomers worrying about a unstable star, and we are staring down the gun barrel of a potential gamma ray burster pointed at us with our name on it.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, I'm going to do exactly as you suggest and go Google away as we go to a break. So, Professor, hold it right there, and we'll come back and talk more about WR104. I hadn't heard a word about WR104, but I hope it's not unstable. Well, I Googled it. It's WR104, a star that twinkles in the sky just 8,000 light years from Earth, is on a path to self-destruction that could result in a cataclysmic explosion. The unstable star, close to us in cosmic terms, is part of a rotating pinwheel system known as WR104 in the constellation of Sagittarius. Experts fear that when the star does explode, it could force a beam of destructive gamma ray radiation toward Earth. Great, just what I needed to hear tonight. Just exactly what I needed to hear. Back to Dr. Kaku in a moment. Well, all right, a real world wrecker, 104. Professor, it's 8,000 light years away, is that right?
That's right. We used to think that a garden variety supernova wouldn't be that dangerous because it has to be within maybe 100 light years of the Earth. But now we have this new animal called gamma ray bursters, first discovered by the Pentagon, by the way. And they can shoot beams out tens of thousands of light years. These are planet destroyers. They can wipe out whole star systems. Their explosion is second only to the Big Bang, second only to the Big Bang. And we see them several times a day, except they are in other galaxies, millions of light years away. Okay, and we can still see them. They light up the entire universe, by the way. This one is right in our backyard. It's in our galaxy, not a distant galaxy.
Okay.
And it's pointed at us. We are staring down the crosshairs of an unstable star. Now, the bad news is, maybe 8,000 years ago, it already exploded.
That's what I was about to ask you. In other words, we're looking back 8,000 years, and we're seeing it look not exactly stable, yes?
Yeah, you can actually see a video of it spinning. The Hubble Space Telescope and other telescopes have been tracking it very carefully, and you can actually see on the web the spinning double star system. So we know we're staring down the gun barrel because we know the axis of rotation of this double star. So the bad news is maybe 8,000 years ago it already blew up, and we're too stupid to know it, and you're doing your laundry tomorrow, and without warning, a gamma ray burst comes by and fries you, and you're dead. You're dust. You're toast.
There were a number of Israeli scientists who believed that a gamma ray burst is what killed the dinosaurs.
It's conceivable. Carl Sagan used to write that perhaps, before the comet theory became more accepted, that a nearby supernova wiped out the dinosaurs. However, we scanned the heavens. There are no close supernovas to the sun capable of wiping out life on Earth. But gamma ray bursters, this new phenomenon discovered, by the Pentagon in the 1970s, they can shoot beams of light, gamma rays, tens of thousands of light years, and we're staring down the gun barrel of this potential exploding star.
So, Professor, it could happen any moment, and there would be no warning. Is that correct?
Right. You cannot go faster than the speed of light. So this shockwave, this gamma ray burst coming from the North Pole and the South Pole, could hit the Earth with very little warning, and you're toast, literally toast, and you wouldn't even know what hit you.
Well, that's what I was going to next ask. Would it be instantaneous? Would there be some pre-shock? Would there be...
Yeah, you would get some indication. In other words, your telescope would look into the past, see the light as it comes, and you would gradually see the initial explosion take place. But once the gamma ray burst comes out, like a gun, like a rifle bullet,
right?
Okay, then you're going to be fried very soon. Now, we track these things in other galaxies, millions of light years away. They peak very rapidly. The spike lasts only for a few minutes. And by the way, in the 1970s, the Pentagon was shocked when they saw these things for the first time in outer space. They thought it was the Russians. They thought the Russians were detonating hydrogen bombs in outer space until we physicists told the Pentagon that these are coming from other galaxies. And the Pentagon said, well, nothing can reach us from another galaxy. Well, here they are, gamma ray bursters. They are, in some sense, black holes in formation.
Okay, well, a little morbid curiosity. How much time do you imagine we might have between when the best telescope saw it begin to happen and the gamma rays hit us?
More realistically, I think we would have a few days' warning. In the sense, we would begin to see the stars becoming more unstable, brighter and brighter, and imploding. And after the implosion comes the detonation, and then you would have this gamma ray burst come out. But the gamma ray burst itself travels at the speed of light. So the actual burst would give you almost no warning at all. But you would see the instability of the star. And like I said, on the web, you can actually see it. There are time-lapse photographs of it taken by astronomers on the web that you can download right now. Now, here's the good news. Okay, that was the bad news.
Any good news?
The bad news is that it may have already detonated 8,000 years ago.
And the good news?
The good news is that, first of all, if you calculate the angle at which it points, the latest calculation shows that it may just miss us, okay? We're staring down the gun barrel, but it may be slightly misaligned. Also, some astronomers are saying that maybe it's not spinning fast enough. Gamma-ray bursters spin very, very fast, and they usually occur in small galaxies, spinning very fast. Our galaxy is quite large. Our galaxy does not spin so fast. And so maybe this could be a dud.
Maybe.
It would just be a garden variety supernova.
Well,
but
okay.
We don't know.
Suppose we took a grazing hit. What would that amount to?
Oh, it wouldn't be pleasant at all. First of all, the ozone layer would be blown off. The ozone layer protects us from getting sunburns in a few seconds by walking outside. All animals with eyes would die as a consequence. Would have severe, it would wipe out communication on the planet Earth. Blow off the ozone layer, it would be a death warrant to walk outside for any length of time. Commerce would come to a halt as a consequence. It would be very unpleasant living in a world where even a grazing blow destabilized the weather and rained radiation down. People could come down with very severe burns to their bodies.
How quickly would it, I mean, these events do pass fairly quickly, don't they, a matter of days?
Well, the actual burst itself is very short-lived. We're talking about a few minutes. That's why we missed it for so long. These intense spikes from distant galaxies that the Pentagon finally discovered with their Vela satellite back in the 1970s, they peak very rapidly. But like I said before, they can be visible throughout the universe. If WR-104 blows up, it will illuminate the entire universe. Everywhere, every point in the universe at some point will see the aftershocks of the explosion of WR-104. That's why we see them in distant galaxies, not just 8,000 light years away, tens of millions to billions of light years away. We see them. These gamma ray bursters, like I said, are second only to the Big Bang.
And well, it almost sounds as though you'd rather get a direct hit than a grazing blow.
A direct hit, you would not know what hit you. You'd be fried. You have a blistering rain of radiation coming down. It would just blow off the atmosphere, fry everything on the Earth. Temperatures would soar as a consequence. The radiation would be intense. You couldn't live in a situation like that if it was a direct hit from the gamma ray burster.
Okay. Back to your book, Physics of the Impossible. Just one more moment with precognition.
Mm-hmm, sure.
As a theoretical physicist, if what happened to me happened to you, how would that affect you?
Well, first, I guess I would be kind of shaken because, of course, you know, we're only human. Then later, I would, I guess, put on my physicist hat.
Mm-hmm.
And say, well, maybe it was a coincidence, you know, maybe not, you know, synchronicity, maybe accidentality, you know, who knows?
No, you wouldn't think that.
But I tend to think that I'd be pretty shaken up if there was really an incident that happened that was staring you in the face.
Yes, right? Well, when I tell it to you, it's just anecdotal. If you were to actually experience it yourself, would it shake the foundations of what you believe?
Well, I think it would create some cracks.
Okay. All right. Let's jump back to the class one impossibilities. Mm-hmm. Psychokinesis mm-hmm. is listed, and I would have thought that had been way down at class three.
No, because, for example, we can now access the brain, like I said, a very crude way by just putting a chip on the surface of the brain,
mm-hmm.
learning how to manipulate a laptop. But once you can manipulate a laptop, you can manipulate magnets placed in different things around you. And in the future, we're going to have very powerful magnets, maybe even room temperature superconductors. We don't have them yet. But if we have a room temperature superconductor and you put a belt on with a magnet, you can fly like Superman. You can have flying cars, just like in Minority Report and Star Wars. Room temperature superconductors could create a second industrial revolution. flying cars, flying people, magnetism for free.
Boy, we could sure use that.
Yeah, I mean, we could lift huge objects just by thinking about it. Again, by a chip in the brain connected to a computer, connected to a magnet that could then lift large objects. Somebody from a primitive culture watching this would say, this is what a magician could do.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I quote from Arthur C. Clarke, who just recently passed away.
Yes.
His famous quotation was that any sufficiently advanced technology is mm-hmm. indistinguishable from magic.
Right.
So we are talking about magic, the magic of psychokinesis, which I think we will realize as we access the brain, as we develop superconductors that have enormous magnetic fields, as we can begin to levitate objects. Maglev trains already exist, by the way. They're very expensive. But if we have room temperature superconductors, maglev trains, maglev cars, floating cars, hoverboards, may become commonplace.
Professor, where are we with respect to superconductors nearing room temperature? I've seen articles claiming that they're getting close.
Liquid nitrogen was the benchmark. Liquid nitrogen is very cold, but it's cheap as milk. So we physicists love liquid nitrogen because it's so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
We can now create superconductors that are superconducting at liquid nitrogen temperatures. So now, even in high school laboratories, we can create superconductors for high school kids now because we have high-temperature superconductors. They're called high-TC that become superconducting at liquid nitrogen temperatures, which even high school kids can access. But room temperature superconductors, we don't have that yet. That could spark a second industrial revolution. I mean, think about it. Million Gauss magnetic fields that we can play with. By the way, the unit of magnetism is one Tesla,
mm-hmm.
Just as a footnote. We physicists want to make sure that Tesla lives forever. And so we named the unit of magnetism one Tesla. When you get your brain scan, you get hit with 10,000 Gauss of magnetism. That's one T of magnetism. So we want to make sure that Tesla, even though his patents were stolen from him, basically, we want to make sure that his name will live forever.
Well, I think it will. Perpetual motion machines, class 3. Now, that I can buy. A perpetual motion machine simply ignores everything we even think we know. It just can't be.
Right.
Or can it?
Well, I get telephone calls from the Wall Street Journal asking me to evaluate certain inventors who are raking in millions of dollars, not just a few thousand, but millions of dollars. And there's several of these people convincing wealthy people that they can extract energy from nothing, just from nothing, solve the energy crisis.
I know. I get the calls all the time.
Yeah, and I look at them, you know, I have an open mind to even bizarre things, but I can very rapidly tell exactly where the mistake is. And so, I quote to Wall Street Journal the famous words of P.T. Barnum, quote, there's a sucker born every minute.
Mm. They never want to open the boxes.
These are investors. They know nothing about physics, nothing about thermodynamics. And then there they go, half-cocked, throwing millions of dollars, chasing after inventions which violate all the known laws of physics.
Well, how do you imagine all those laws of physics will be violated to finally allow it?
Well, like I said, it's possible that the so-called known laws of physics could be violated. For example, at the center of a black hole and the beginning of the universe, Einstein's equations are useless. So there we have an incompleteness right there. The most interesting places in the universe, the origin of the universe, the center of a black hole, cannot be accessed by Einstein's equations. We have to use a higher set of equations, string theory. That's where string theory comes in. That allows us to probe the pre-Big Bang era. And so then new laws of physics have to be developed as a consequence. In fact, many of my colleagues work in the pre-Big Bang universe. And in 2014, we're going to launch a satellite that may actually detect the presence of an alternate universe that existed before the Big Bang. The satellite is called LISA,
wow.
L for laser. And it will detect shock waves, gravity shock waves from the instant of the Big Bang. We have baby pictures of the Big Bang, by the way, when it was about 300,000 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
We have baby pictures of the explosion. Go to nasa.gov and type in microwave background radiation, And there you can see it. You can actually see the embers of the explosion right on the web of the Big Bang itself.
Wow.
Now, with LISA, we'll be able to detect the instant of the Big Bang, not the aftershock, not the explosion, but the instant.
The actual instant.
Yeah, and we hope to find evidence of a womb and maybe an umbilical cord connecting our universe to a parallel universe. This is taken seriously now, and NASA is throwing money at it. So we hope to be able to get signals from the pre-Big Bang universe. And maybe our universe fissioned from another universe. These are called baby universes. And
how would they discern the energy levels from our Big Bang or that instant, or then discern some other energy from some other universe? How would they discern?
Yeah, here's how we do it. When, let's say you assume that two universes collide, two bubble universes collide, or a bubble universe peels off a baby universe. They would give off a characteristic radiation after the Big Bang. They make a prediction as to what the Big Bang looks like. Therefore, it's like a fingerprint. Therefore, once we get pictures of the instant of creation in the next decade with our gravity wave detectors, we simply compare it. Compare the radiation to the prediction of other pre-Big Bang universes. And that's how we begin to roll them out. So I think there's going to be a renaissance in Big Bang physics in the next decade with satellites, not just baby pictures, but the instant of creation and radiation from the pre-Big Bang era. That's one of the hottest topics now in string theory, because string theory allows you to go before the Big Bang, allows you to go before Genesis. And perhaps there was a multiverse of universes.
Professor, I had a caller in the first hour who said, who asked, how, for example, if two large black holes were to collide, there would be a release of an incredible, enormous amount of energy. And how would you compare, could you compare that kind of release of energy to the original Big Bang?
Well, we have a gravity wave detector on the Earth right now called LIGO, L-I-G-O. It's several miles long. It's a laser beam that can detect any jiggling of disruptions in outer space. And we're looking for colliding black holes. The LIGO should be sensitive enough to pick up radiation from colliding black holes. But that's minuscule compared to the radiation of the Big Bang itself. For example, when you tune your radio and you get that static between radio stations, roughly 10% or so of that static comes from the Big Bang. Believe it or not, you can actually pick up signals from Genesis tonight by detuning your radio between stations, picking up static, and 10-15% of that static is left over from Genesis.
Wow.
You can actually pick it up on your radio tonight.
Wow. Well, I wouldn't be able to discern it, but you're saying that percentage is
that
indeed
static, that hissing sound, a good fraction of the hissing sound. Another large fraction comes from Jupiter. Jupiter also causes a lot of disruption of our radio. But the background hissing sound, a lot of it comes from Genesis itself. So again, you don't have to believe in the Big Bang theory, but we have pictures of it, photographs of the explosion. And you can even detect it tonight on your radio.
Well, I've not had that experience, but I understand what you're saying. What I have been able to discern is 50 megahertz, 6 meter amateur band. You do a lot of listening there, Professor, waiting for an opening, you know, an E-skip opening or something. But every now and then you'll hear this sudden rise in background levels. I mean, 10 or even 15 dB rise. And then all of a sudden you'll get the news that there's just been a big solar flare. But you heard it first. We'll be right back.